This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Once again, people are trying to figure out what to make of Larry Flynt, who is my guest. Is he a sleazebag, a pioneering free speech advocate, a lunatic, all of the above? His life is examined in the new film, The People vs. Larry Flynt, starring Woody Harrelson as Flynt, and in his new memoir, An Unseemly Man. Both chart his rise from bar owner to publisher of the taboo-breaking magazine Hustler, which launched his magazine empire. Much of the film focuses on Flynt's First Amendment court battles, defending his explicit nude photographs and raunchy cartoons and satires. He went as high as the Supreme Court and won. During one of his court battles in 1978, he was shot by a would-be assassin, leaving his legs paralyzed and his speech slurred. Before we begin, be advised that we're going to be talking about adult subject matter, which may even make some adults uncomfortable. I asked Flynt first for his reaction to the new film.
I like the movie an awful lot. I would like it even if it wasn't about me. I just think it was really fantastic. I was surprised that Columbia wanted to make the picture. I didn't know if the timing was right or not, because normally they don't make biopics about people who are alive. They're usually dead, because people are concerned about their image as to how they're portrayed on the big screen. But I said, it's my life. It happened. Do it. Just get it right. And I worked as a script consulting with them, but I didn't have any casting or script approval, and I didn't want it. I felt that the director, Milos Forman, should make the movie as he's seen it. And
Do you see yourself any differently watching yourself as portrayed in the movie? Do you feel any differently about any of your past actions watching the movie, or...
No, because they took very few creative liberties in making this movie. It's relatively accurate. It was very painful to watch some of it, like my shooting and the death of my wife. But I've dealt with all of that, and I'm happy that the movie's been made and that I've written the book, because everyone knows me. They know I publish Hustler, but they know little about how the last couple of decades unfolded in terms of the various legal cases that I was involved in, and many of the controversies surrounding my life. So I think the movie and the book will put everything in the proper perspective for those who are interested.
A lot of the movie revolves around your free speech trials and the ambivalence that a lot of civil libertarians had about you. They wanted to defend your rights and thereby protect the rights of everybody, but a lot of those people who wanted to protect your rights didn't particularly like your publications. How important is the First Amendment to you? I mean, I guess to put it bluntly, do you see your trials for you as having been more a matter of principle or more a matter about the ability to make a lot of money?
Well, when I first started out, I was only interested in making money and wanted to have fun at what I was doing. I think I had to stand in a courtroom and listen to a judge sentence me to 25 years in prison before I realized that freedom of expression was something that could no longer be taken for granted. You know, a free press is not freedom for the thought you love, but rather for the thought you hate the most. And when the Founding Fathers wrote the First Amendment, they didn't qualify it. They simply said Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. While some people might find certain publications, such as Hustler or others, offensive, that's the price they have to pay to live in a free society, and that's toleration. People have to tolerate the Larry Flynts of the world so they can be free. And it's magazines like Hustler that need protection of the First Amendment, not Time or Newsweek, because they're not going to offend anyone. And freedom's only important if it's offensive.
Well, just to put in a word here, I think mainstream publications have had their run-ins with the courts over free speech issues, too. But in the movie, your lawyer is depicted as just getting fed up with you sometimes and some of your antics in court. Your stunts in court, as depicted in the movie, are the time when you wore a diaper to court, which I know you did in real life, And a time when you were fined $10,000 for withholding a source in contempt of court. And then you had models show up with trash bags filled with the cash, which they dumped on the floor of the courtroom. Did that actually happen too, the $10,000?
Yes, and of course the DAPR was made out of American flag. But there's an interesting story behind that. Annie Leibovitz, a photographer of Vanity Fair, was photographing me for a feature for the magazine. She wanted me draped on my couch in an American flag. My attorney calls me and says, you've got to be in court in an hour. And I said, I can't do it. He said, if you don't, the judge is going to hold you in contempt. By this time, I was so fed up the way they were treating me in terms of trying to force me to reveal my source, because I felt if I was CBS or Washington Post, it wouldn't have even been an issue. And I just said, you know, if they're going to treat me like a kid, I'll act like one. And that was the reason for my bizarre behavior. And I'm not saying it's justified. I'm not even saying it's appropriate. I probably wouldn't even do it if I had it to do over again. But those are my motivations for what happened.
At a time when your lawyer was so fed up with you, he was ready to just give up on you and sever professional relations, he said to you, at least in the movie he said to you, that you claim to be defending the First Amendment, yet you show no respect for the courts that are supposed to uphold it. And I'm wondering what you think about that. You know, someone who has been in all these First Amendment trials and who, in fact, showed very little respect for the court.
I think the point that he made was interesting, and it actually happened. And I don't disagree with his position, but by the time we had had this discussion, I'd already been shot and paralyzed during an obscenity trial in Georgia. I didn't really give a damn at that point about the Supreme Court or any other court, because my attitude was, you know, what are you going to do to me now? Kill me? I mean, that was the reason why I so vigilantly fought that battle all the way.
It wasn't the courts that shot you.
Well, that's true. It wasn't. But it was 5 years before the government ever revealed the name of the man who shot me. I felt there was a great many members of the establishment that were sort of happy to see me shot on that street in Georgia that day.
Tell us what you publish now. Give us a sense of the number of magazines, which magazines you publish and distribute.
I publish over 20 magazines now. Only six of them are adult titles. I have two music magazines, Rip and Rap Pages. I do two boating magazines. I do some computer magazines. All mainstream publications.
Before you started publishing men's magazines, you ran several bars, which became go-go bars, with, I believe, topless dancers. Who were the men you were going after? Did you have a very conscious approach toward figuring out who your clientele was going to be and how you were going to attract them?
You mean in the clubs or the magazine?
In the clubs.
We primarily catered to the traveling businessman who we felt would rather spend the evening watching a pretty girl dance or having a drink in the club and staying in his hotel room and possibly watching the Johnny Carson show. That was the primary focus of our clientele, and the clubs were quite successful.
When you launched Hustler magazine in 1974, how did you want it to be different from other men's magazines? Specifically, how did you see it in relationship to Playboy, which was the best known, most popular?
Well, I always felt and still feel that Playboy presents women that give an unattainable fantasy to men. You know, the 6-foot-tall blonde with a 40-inch bust and a very plastic-looking setting. I felt guys wanted to see more of, you know, the girl next door, whether she might have small breasts, medium or large, or be a brunette or a blonde, the type of girl you might even see at your local market. And this had a lot to do with the mass appeal of Hustler. And, of course, I didn't have a formal education when I started, so I wasn't trying to portray myself as any sort of literary giant. I just wanted to appeal, to the average guy. And that's what I did. We created humor for Hustler, which is considered tasteless and lowbrow and many times offensive, but it's the type of humor that you hear and see in the workplace, in the factories. And also the magazine had a great deal of political satire and political overtones where we were, always lampooning the politicians. And basically it was the political satire that really got us in trouble, more so than the photo features that we were publishing.
My guest is Larry Flint. The movie about him opens December 27th. His new memoir is called An Unseemly Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Larry Flint, he has a new memoir called An Unseemly Man, My Life as Pornographer, Pundit, and Social Outcast. Your first so-called pink issue, in which a woman was photographed graphically with her legs spread, was in November of 1974. What made you go in that direction? How did you decide to go in that direction?
A female genitalia is the most erotic part of the female body. And that's what the man wants to see. To the man, it's a flower. And men are spending their whole life trying to get back into where they came from.
I'm wondering if you felt that a lot of men, and say teenagers, bought the magazine in a way out of curiosity because they'd never seen a detailed photograph of a woman like that before, and they wanted to know what it looked like.
I've never been asked that question. It's a very good possibility. No doubt when they buy their first issue, it's from curiosity. But I remember in the very beginning, when I first started Hustler and first did the first pink shots, I was with my lawyer, not the one in the movie in the case, but a different lawyer, having dinner at his house one night. He must have been 60, 65 years old. His wife was the same age. And she had looked at the magazine, and she made a comment at the dinner table. She said, I never realized that I looked like that down there. That was a statement that stayed with me over the years. And I don't think women see this part of their anatomy as being beautiful and erotic, but men do.
I'm wondering if when you started photographing pink, whether you had to develop a kind of photographic language for it. I mean, what I mean is that because women weren't shown like that before, there wasn't a kind of set of ideas about what the right erotic way of display was.
That part of the body is, we felt, also needed to be well-groomed. That, in a sense, a woman's vagina had as much personality as her face. And we just wanted the photography to bring this out. So it was as much concerned about how her genitalia looked as we were about how her face looked.
When you started photographing women's genitals for Hustler, in a way you were photographing a perfected ideal of women's bodies, in the sense that, I mean, you started to create this language of what women should look like, shaved in a certain way and probably prepped in a certain way. I'm wondering, why shaved?
Well, that's very interesting, because what has happened over the last two decades is 20 years ago, men thought it was a great deal more erotic appeal, that the pubic hair was there. The bushier, the better. And now with the new generation that's coming along, you know, it's completely the opposite. You see many girls, you know, and not just because of their job or because of going to the beach or what have you, are shaving on a regular basis because younger men are preferring this. Now, if you took a poll in men over 40, you would get the complete opposite that you would for men under 40.
As you know, Hustler magazine has been criticized for being sexist, for being insulting to women. Do you think the magazine condescends to women? Or, you know, just presents them as sex objects in a condescending or insulting way?
Women are their most glorious in their birthday suit, and that's the way men want to see them.
Let's stop. What does that mean? Women are most glorious when they're naked. What does that say about them when they're clothed? What do you mean?
No, I'm saying that's the way men want to see them. Now, you can talk about women being used as a sex symbol, exploited. You know, the feminist can preach this all day long, and it just doesn't change the fact that men love and adore women, and they see them as sexual objects. Now, don't get me wrong, that's not all that men see women as. You know, they lack for some intelligence and compassion to come along with it. But I'm saying that women will always be a sex symbol, and that's human nature, and you're never going to be able to change that. And the feminists are going to have to learn to accept that. I think the women's movement has been good. It's came a long way. I believe in equal rights, equal pay, no discrimination. But I think women will always enjoy having car doors open for them. And I hope that the glorious dynams of the world have come to realize that many men are now willing to sleep on the wet spot.
Is that your idea of feminism? Men being able to sleep on the wet spot? Now, I have to ask you about a notorious cover for Hustler magazine that I guess to some women epitomized what they didn't like about the magazine. And it was the meat grinder cover, where you had a picture of a naked woman being put head first through a meat grinder with the caption, "Grade A pink." What was the point of that?
Well, it was an effort at humor that we fell flat on. You know,
I'll say.
It didn't work. It shouldn't have been done. It's a regret. But, hey, we all make mistakes. Every once in a while, you might screw a show up, you know. Sometimes we can't help it.
What was the point in your mind when you published it?
Well, it was intended to be humorous.
What was the joke?
Well, it was just so absurd and so outrageous that we felt people would laugh at it rather than to take it so seriously.
Now, you became a millionaire after publishing nude photographs of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. And while the merits of Hustler are surely, you know, debatable, publishing nude photos of someone against their will, that seems like, you know, just an invasion of privacy and a pretty reprehensible thing to do. And I'm wondering how you justify publishing nude photos of somebody when that person doesn't want those photos published.
Anyone that becomes a public figure gives up any right they have to privacy. Because if you're a public figure, you place yourself there because of your actions or your profession or your association. So being a public figure, you pay a price for that. And one of those prices is your privacy.
Well, there's a difference between there's privacy and privacy. I mean, do you want to live in this kind of society where people are hiding in the bushes taking photographs of people who think that they're, you know, alone, taking photographs of them naked? And in a world where that could just be published and there's some kind of lofty principle to justify it?
Well, it raises the question of where are you going to draw the line in
right.
terms of a free press.
Right.
You can't give it to one person and not to another. Now, no system is perfect, and our system is not, but it is the, still yet the best in the world. But we amazingly have a free press that has worked quite well for 200 years, and it's got more efficient and better as time has gone by. I would hope, you know, that, you know, the matter of privacy could be dealt with in some manner that would not restrict freedom of press.
Larry Flynt, he has a new memoir called An Unseemly Man. The movie about him opens December 27th. We'll talk a little bit more about his decision to publish those Jacqueline Onassis photographs in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Larry Flynt. He's the subject of the new film, The People vs. Larry Flynt, which stars Woody Harrelson as Flynt. And he's written a memoir called An Unseemly Man, My Life as Pornographer, Pundit, and Social Outcast. When we left off, we were talking about the edition of Hustler magazine, which featured nude photos of Jacqueline Onassis and sold so well it made Flynt a millionaire. I told him that's a perfect example of why he's such a problematic figure for First Amendment advocates. Yes, he's fought for free speech and almost lost his life in the process. But in the name of free speech, he does something repugnant, like publishing nude photos of a former First Lady. I asked him if decency, respect, empathy ever entered into his decision to publish those photos.
You know, I wish I had some remorse about the issue that you're discussing, but I don't. I think it's it all, you know, takes second place to the First Amendment, which gets its vitality and meaning from the unrestricted right of free choice.
Yeah, but just because there's a First Amendment and we want to uphold it doesn't mean you get off the hook that easily for doing something.
We have libel laws. If you libel someone or make a statement of fact that's untrue, they can sue you and collect damages. Now, Jacqueline Onassis could have sued me. She chose not to, and she probably would have won. But that's the reason why I published the photographs, is I was gambling that she would not sue. But let's don't confuse the issue of libel with the issue of a free press. A free press does not give you the right to libel anyone. And in a famous case I have with the Reverend Jerry Falwell, the jury found there were no libel, but they still wanted me to pay him $200,000 for hurting his feelings. I took that case to the Supreme Court, and I won it. And I think it's important that I did win it for the nation. And I think the ramifications would have been absolutely horrible if it would have gone in the other direction.
If somebody was able to give you naked photographs of Hillary Clinton, would you print them?
Oh, in a heartbeat. You know, I could sell more new photographs of Hillary Clinton than I could Cindy Crawford. You know, it's a controversy, the status symbol, the icon, you know, that they're buying. You know, they're buying a moment of sensationalism.
Exactly. And that's okay by you. So you'd have no compunctions if it were against her will, if she didn't know the photos were being taken, you'd have no compunctions to...
No, maybe Bill's got some old Polaroids laying around somewhere, you know.
Now, there was a period, I guess it was in the late 70s, when the president was Jimmy Carter, when his sister, Ruth Carter Stapleton, called you and basically tried to and succeeded in converting you to Christianity, and you were baptized. What was behind your conversion? Do you feel, looking back on it, that it was genuine on your part?
Well, first, I'm thankful I got over that, but the press again misrepresented that. Ruth Carter Stapleton really didn't have anything to do with the conversion. She was a very close friend, But it was a very profound and real experience that I had. Most people who go through these sort of spiritual experiences in their life, the only people they have to seek counsel from is family or neighbors or friend or local pastor. And fortunately, I was able to seek professional help to realize what I was going through. And I'm a classic manic depressive, and I truly believe I was just in one of my manic phases at the time this happened. And I know that's probably upset a lot of Christians out there living, but if these born-againers would just take a little lithium, you know, these visions would go away and the voices would disappear and they'd be okay.
So you're back to being an atheist?
Yes.
How long was your conversion? How long did it last?
Just a few months.
Mm-hmm. Larry Flint is my guest. You were shot in 1978 during an obscenity trial in Lawrenceville, Georgia. Can I ask you to remember for us what you remember of that moment when you were shot?
Well, it was a sunny summer day in a quaint little southern city, and it was the last thing we would ever expected to happen. And myself and my lawyer were both shot returning from a lunch break to the courthouse. And I didn't realize at the time how bad I was hurt, but I was almost 15 years fully recovering.
You've described the pain after being shot as feeling like you were being boiled alive.
Yeah, you can't discuss pain with people that's never experienced it. We've all had headaches or bruised our thumb or stumped our toe. But until you've had nerve damage, you really don't know what real pain is. And I had to take painkillers for literally most of those years until a surgery was finally developed that would alleviate the pain.
So are you pain-free now?
Yes.
I'm wondering if during the period when you were in great pain and not interested in sex and not able to enjoy it in any way, if while you were publishing Hustler, you ever started to feel really detached from the subject matter and start to really wonder, why are people so obsessed with sexuality?
I never felt detached from the subject matter, but I felt very badly that I wasn't able to participate in the process of what we were doing with the company. But no, as far as sex itself goes, look, it's a medium that we use to communicate with more than anything else, and you would think we'd make a little bit better effort to understand it more. You know, you can run the most horrific photograph you want on the front page of a newspaper with a mutilated, decapitated body, and it might even give you a Pulitzer Prize for it. But you run a photograph of a sexual image on the front page of that newspaper, and you could very well go to jail or be put out of business. So that says something significant about the priorities that we place on sex and violence.
You've been a very successful businessman running your magazines. Do you think your motivation has been, over the years, more sexual or more financial?
Oh, boy. I think my desire for sex was always in the forefront of my desire for money. All right. I read a motivational book back in the 60s that said the same energy that you use for sex can be channeled into making you a successful business person. So I tried to adopt some of that philosophy.
Were men's magazines a part of your sexual coming of age?
No. I had not really paid any attention to men's magazines until I decided to publish Hustler nationally. And at that time, I made my observation.
Why do you think that you were uninterested in them as a person? I mean, you were obviously interested in them as a businessman, but just as a person, they were of no interest to you.
Well, it sounds strange, but I hadn't really seen them, and sex was a very, you know, predominant part of my life, and I never really felt the need to pursue these magazines. But the more I got into Publishing Hustle, the more I came involved in sexuality and realized that pornography is really the purest form of art.
Larry Flynt has written a new memoir called An Unseemly Man. The movie The People vs. Larry Flynt opens December 27th. Tomorrow, we'll feature an interview with the director of the film, Milos Forman. This is Fresh Air.